I apologize. And I copied out an, I copied some news sources for this week, but I had some printing problems, so I just printed it now at home, but I didn't have a copier, so I will have to recite some of the sources by heart, or at least for you it will be Bob Pat, for me I'll be reading from my sheets.
Oh, shoot.
Okay, fine. So let me begin. Okay, this is the Laws of Inheritance and Halakha, Part 3. Last week we spoke about the Rambam's unique position of how Yerusha constitutes Chukas Mishpat. It constitutes some sort of a davar shebe iser, some type of a ritual matter, which is not subject to tanaim, it's not subject to conditions, and we use that Rambam to explain how, according to the Rambam, there is a basic aspect of Yerusha, which is monetary in nature, and would be subject to conditions, but then there's another aspect, which is the Chukas Mishpat aspect, which is not subject to making conditions, and on that basis, we explained the exposition of Velvel Soloveitchik, the Brisker of the Rambam's position regarding the Yerusha of a Ger who inherits from his father, that the Rambam says explicitly, he makes a special point of saying explicitly that this is subject to conditions, and Velvel Soloveitchik explains that this is because the Rambam is of the opinion that when the rabbis enacted that a ger will inherit from his father, even though he's not halakhically related to him anymore, they only enacted the monetary aspect of inheritance, which is subject to making conditions, but not the chukas mishpat, the ritual aspect of inheritance, which would not be subject to making conditions, and that's why a condition would be possible. So I just wanted to point out, this is not in the sources in front of you, the Rambam has an interesting comment. The Rambam says that hisne habal shelo yiskaya be'echa min adram shukaya behen. Let's say that when a man, we spoke about the special nature of the inheritance of a husband inheriting his wife, and we pointed out that both the Rambam and the other Rishonim explain that based on the Gemara, this is an exception to the general rule as well. This is a case where we do allow for a condition to be made, the husband to be, to make a condition after the eris and the betrothal has taken place between himself and his kala, that he is not going to inherit from his kala. He's not going to inherit from his wife once the ability to inherit sets in, and that's at the time of the nisuin. And there are two different explanations given as to why a condition is possible in this case. One is that of the Tosfos Arid. Tosfos Arid, Suvas Pei Gimel, says that the reason is because it is only midrabanan. So machlokis as to whether the inheritance of a husband of his wife is midaraisa midrabanan. Tosfos Arid assumes that it's only midrabanan and says that for this rabbinic type of Yerusha, it's on a lower level. We therefore will allow for a waiver, a condition to set in under these circumstances. And we said that according to the Rambam learns that the Yerusha of a husband of his, that a husband inherits from his wife is in fact only midrabanan. But the Rambam seems to give a different explanation as to why it is that this is subject to a condition. Doesn't say it's because it's rabbinic in nature, but rather it's really based on the wording of the Gemara that says it's a nachla bolo the adam imakom achir, that it's an inheritance that is coming to the person from somewhere else. They didn't automatically have a vested interest in this inheritance, since the husband is only stepping in to the position of being able to inherit at the time of the nisuin, so therefore he has a moment in time in which he can be misalik himself, in which he can distance himself, he can remove himself from the ability to be Yoresh, his wife, and say that since there is no vested interest that is there yet, he is going to step away and going to relinquish the right to inherit from his wife when the time comes. So the Rambam has an interesting comment about what is subject to condition when a man and a woman get married to each other. He says, this is in Hilchos Ishus, Perek Yud Beis, Halacha Bav. The Rambam says, Nisna Baal Shal Yishchai Bechem in Adram Shchai Behen. If a husband makes a condition when he marries his wife, that he's, when he betroths her, actually, that he's not going to be obligated in one of the different duties and obligations of a husband, or alternatively, the wife-to-be, makes a condition that the husband is not going to receive something he's entitled to under the terms of the marriage. Hatanai kayim. Normally, when we're dealing again with any type of a monetary condition, the condition would be valid because we paskin like Rabbi Yehuda, kol davashim of the mamon to know kayim. In any monetary matter, the condition is considered to be valid and binding. Chutz, with the exception, mishlosha dvarim. The exception of three different things, she'ena tanai mo behen, with a tanai, with a condition, would not be binding. What are those three things? If anyone would make a condition with respect to any one of these three things, the tanai, the condition, would be null and void. The marriage would still be a valid marriage, but the condition would be null and void. And these are the three. Onasa. One of them is the husband's obligation of conjugal relations with his wife, because that's not a davar shebamamon. Clearly, that's not a monetary type of matter, and therefore it's not subject to a condition. Second is v'ikar kesubasa, that the ikar kesuba, that if the wife waives her right to receive the kesuba, so then that waiver is considered to be null and void. Now, we spoke about this a little bit in the context of prenuptial agreements. If you have a couple that's getting married, particularly if it's a second marriage, so they'll often waive any monetary rights, the rights of each one to the assets of the other, that the various assets should be untouchable, and among the clauses that are typically included in that type of monetary prenuptial agreement is that they waive their rights to inherit from each other. And we mentioned that there was a concern of the Divrei Malkiyah. What does it mean from a halakhic perspective for a wife to waive her rights of inheritance from her husband, because halakhically she doesn't inherit from her husband anyway? What does she get from her husband? She gets the kesuva. So if he says that it could be that the proper interpretation from our perspective of such a clause in a prenuptial agreement is that she is waiving her rights to the ketuba, or she waives her rights to the ketuba, so we have a halakha of Rabbi Meir that asal adam lishos mishto shachas bli ksuva. A man is not allowed to live with his wife even for 1 hour, for one moment, unless he has a ksuba. That's why people sometimes come to me at the Bezdin, and they're horrified, they moved somewhere, and then they're looking through their papers, and they discover they can't find the ksuba. They come to the Bezdin, and they say, quick, I need a replacement ksuba. It's called the ksuba de erkesa. That's one of the things that we do, that we write a ksuba de erkesa for people who can't, have misplaced their ksuba, because of this din of Rabbi Meir, that we paskin like, that you're not allowed to live together if you don't have the ksuba. It's a very, very important halacha. However, here, presumably, if she has waived her ksuba, and the Rambam just said that the waiver is going to be null and void, so what are we worried about exactly? Really, then, the ksuba still is an obligation, and then they should be able to live with each other. So, put that to the side for a moment. The third case that the Rambam talks about that is not subject to waivers, Yerushasa, is that he says a husband cannot waive his right to inherit his wife. So we just said that's a qualified halacha in the Rambam. Because when is that true, that the husband can't waive his right to inherit from his wife? That's only after the Nisuin, right? But before the Nisuin, he's allowed to waive the right. But as we mentioned, it's a little bit complicated because the Ran writes that it has to be in a very small frame of time between the Erisin and the Nisuin. Before the Erisin, he has no shaykhus, he has no connection whatsoever to her inheritance, so therefore it's like a davar shelo ba'aliyolam, something which is not on the horizon. He can't make stipulations with respect to something that's not on the horizon. And after the nisuin, it's too late because it's already vested, so the only time that he has the ability to make this waiver is between the time of the erisin and the time of the nisuin. Very, very short window of time, especially nowadays, and that window of time is approximately 2 minutes between the giving over of the ring and the harayat mekudeshesli under the chuppah and the seven sheva brachos which are recited under the chuppah. Very, very short window of time. Okay, so let's go back now to this notion of ikar ksubasa. So we just have a perfect solution for our problem, right? Because the wife is, even if in the prenuptial agreement she's waiving a right to the ksuba, she doesn't have the right to waive a right to the ksuba. So Shulchan Aruch says not so fast. The Shulchan Aruch paskin is called Pokes Mishir Ksuba. Any husband who stipulates that he's going to give his wife less than the amount of the ksuba that she's entitled to. The ikar ksuba isn't all that much. It's 200 zuz, whatever that comes out to. But he says, I'm not even going to give you the 200 zuz. Bilasa bilus nus. So then he's living with his wife in sin. He's living his wife in sin because they're not considered to have a duly sanctified marriage. So he says, Lomi bayim kaslo acharkach. This is not only true if she started out with a ksuba, and she says, it's kabati mimcha ksuba, that I'm going to treat it as if I've already received the ksuba from you. Omitzasa. Because some supposed to say that actually works. That works. If he starts out at the beginning of the marriage with a ksuba, and then she waives it a few days into the marriage, so that really works, but then they're just living with each other, be'isr. But he says, even if it doesn't work, even if they made a prenuptial agreement or condition, at the time of the kedushin itself, that she's not going to have a ksuba, and therefore you'd figure that, okay, it doesn't work. The Rambam just says that the tanai is batel, afabisha tano batel. Even though the Tanai is considered to be null and void, v'yesh la ksuva mushlam, and she's entitled to her full ksuva, apidohaki bilasa bilasnos. Nonetheless, he's still not allowed to live with her. It will be considered to be living in immorality. Why is that? Kiven she sevua she'ela, because she thinks that she's not going to be entitled to a ksuva. She thinks that she waived whatever right she would have to receive anything at the end of their marriage, so therefore that is enough to make it sinful for them to be living together, even though the waiver does not work. Though some kadaita, because she doesn't expect to receive the sum of the ksuva. Now, you have to ask this preliminary question. We've been talking all this time about how we start off with the fundamental premise that if something is a tanai shebamamon, something is a monetary condition, normally you can make a condition, at least the condition is effective. So the question then becomes, well, why then do we in fact paskin, according to the Rambam, according to the Shulchan Aruch, that if this monetary condition is made to waive the ksuba, fundamentally it is an effective condition. We say he's going to be in trouble, given that because the wife doesn't expect to receive the ksuba and therefore is living with her is going to be sinful anyway. But why is it actually considered to be an ineffective condition, given that it's a tanai shemamamon? We understood when it comes to a person who makes a condition in general with respect to inheritance matters, that it's an ineffective condition because the Rambam said, well, it's a chukas mishpat, right? That maybe it's considered to be a ritual prohibition, or because of the fact that it's something which is already vested and you can't get rid of something that's already vested unless you give it away, but you don't have it in your hands to give it away. Those are the two basic explanations that we gave as to why it is effectively that you can't make a condition with respect to inheritance. But why is it that a condition couldn't be made with respect to the ksuba? So here too it's very interesting that on the flip side of the equation, with respect to the woman receiving the ksuba, not an inheritance, but a monetary right that she has, we find that there is a different set of arguments. One explanation that is given by the Lechem Mishnah. The Lechem Mishnah gives the explanation, you know why it is that the woman cannot waive the ksuba and it would not be considered to be a binding condition. He says, because kima dekol apokes besula. Since we've just established that if you, in fact, are not going to provide a kesuba for your wife, and then you're going to be living with her, you don't have a kesuba, so that's considered to be an immoral sexual relationship. That's considered to be milasa bilasnus. So therefore, chashvinin le lahak midrabanan, that's a rabbinic law, chashvinin le lahak bilasnus, ki'ilu havi de'araisa, we treat it as if it's a bilasnus on a level de'araisa, shehem asu chisek l'divrayim kishel Torah. Because the rabbis say that once we require that you have a ksuba, you don't have a ksuba, so we're going to treat it like you're living in immorality even on a Torah level. So therefore it follows that if we're going to truly treat it like immorality on a Torah level, what's immorality? It's sin, right? What is sin? Sin is an avera. What's an avera? A ritual prohibition. So therefore, we have made this into a ritual prohibition. Perfect, beautiful articulation. I wish I had come up with it myself. Therefore, says the Lechem Mishnah, this is actually considered, according to the Rambam, it's considered a ritual prohibition, much like the Rambam seems to understand that Yerusha is in the realm of ritual law because it says that it's considered to be a chukas mishpat, a ritual type of monetary law, if you will. So too, the ksuba is in the realm of ritual prohibition because not having a ksuba is going to lead to a relationship of immorality. Lekach lamahani tanan. That's why a tanai would not be effective. Okay? The reason why the condition is essentially ineffective is because of this is a davish be'isur. So that's the explanation that the Lechem Mishnah brings. There's an alternative explanation. This explanation is brought in Siman Samach Vav of Eben Ezer, by none other than the Be'er HaGola. Be'er HaGola doesn't really get enough credit because most of the time he's just giving you citations. On the side of the Shulchan Aruch, he says, yeah, this halacha comes from this Gemara, this comes from this Gemara, this Rambam, that Rambam. He doesn't usually say too much, but every once in a while he pipes up and he says something. So the Be'er HaGola says, I'm going to give you an explanation over here as to why this condition is generally not considered to be a valid condition. It says, the Apagav de Kaimalan Ksuva de Rabbanan, even though Ksuva is only, we generally assume, it's only a rabbinic monetary requirement for a husband to give his wife a Ksuva, at least the specific amount of the Ksuva is only de Rabbanan, Rafilu b'shel tola nami dover shebemamon tino kayim, and therefore we should certainly be lenient with respect to the allowance of making a condition, because even with respect to a Torah monetary obligation, we allow people to make conditions. Svirle the Rambam, he says that the Rambam must be of the opinion, and this is an opinion that is recorded in the Gemara, the Chachamim asu chizik ledivrayim yoteh mishel Torah, that the Chachamim, in order to strengthen their laws and to strengthen their words, they made their own laws more rigorous and more airtight than the laws of the Torah. They said, yeah, if this would have been a monetary law that had been decreed by the Torah, so then you'd be allowed to make a condition around it. But since this is our law, it's a rabbinic law, and we're worried that you're not going to take this seriously enough, therefore we're going to make the laws and the conditions more strict, and that we're going to prohibit you from making any kind of a condition. So this is the other explanation as to why really the condition, the Rambam says the condition would be void in this case as well. But it still ends up being a problem if a person would make such a condition that the wife would not receive her ksuva, because she's going to think that she's not entitled to receive the ksuva, and therefore it's still going to lead to the problem of bilasa bilas nos. Something that lawyers have to bear in mind, because if they do have a prenuptial agreement that says the wife is waiving her right to the Yerusha, so since that has no meaning halachically, as the Divrei Malkiel says, it could be that in the wife's mind, that means that she's not even going to be entitled to the ksuba, and she would have a good basis to believe that. You know why? Because there's a court decision that says exactly that. There was a case in New York, 1974. The case is called In Re Estate of White, 356 New York State, 2nd, 208. Okay, Surrogate Court of New York, Queens County. And what happened in this case? A woman and husband were married, and he died. It turns out that right shortly before they got married, they signed an antenuptial agreement, prenuptial agreement. In the prenuptial agreement, she renounced, they gave up, any rights that she would have to her husband's estate in the event that he would die, and sure enough, he died. So then she shows up, and she says, wait a second, I'm still entitled to something from the estate. What is it that she claimed that she was entitled to from the estate? So she showed up in court waving a document. What was that document known as? She was waving the ketubah. She said, hey, we entered into the prenuptial agreement, but we also entered into this ketubah. The ketubah was entered into after the prenuptial agreement. We signed it at the wedding. And the ketubah entitles me to 100 zuz. Apparently it was a second marriage, so it wasn't 200 zuz, it was only 100 zuz, but she wanted her 100 zuz. So she said that this obligation should pass to her from the decedent's estate. The respondent, I'll just read to you from the court decision, the respondent contends that these provisions abrogate the antenuptial agreement, her claim was that she's entitled to the zuzim. His claim was that the prenuptial agreement terminated or superseded any type of obligation that might otherwise exist pursuant to the ketubah. So her claim was that he made this obligation to provide her with 100 zuzim, and therefore she should be entitled to it.
Was she saying that therefore this is superseded, so therefore the
she whole claimed that it came after the prenuptial agreement,
so the whole
and therefore
it's turned out she should get the whole Yerusha?
Not the whole Yerusha, but she should get whatever is the equivalent of 100 zuzim. She wasn't sure exactly how much should be 100 zuzim. 100 zuzim might not end up being too much, but remember that there are opinions that say the 200 zuzim really is reflective of the support that a husband is supposed to pay his wife over the course of a full year, so you could make some sort of an argument that 100 zuzim is half of that, even though really 100 zuzim is 1/16 of 200 zuzim, according to the way we generally interpret these provisions. But in any event, the court didn't get into those picayune points. The court said, in the opinion of this court, after giving particular consideration to the above quote, that they quoted from the affidavit of the rabbi who officiated at the marriage, the decedent understood the contents of the ketubah, and that it must be interpreted under today's laws, applying the law of the land is the law, and the Jewish law says that the widow is entitled to that which the law of the land allows her, and therefore she should be entitled to it. Okay. So in any event, the court ruled that the ketubah, or Jewish marriage contract, has no binding effect on the property rights of the signers under the laws of the state of New York. No contractual rights are given to the surviving spouse under the terms of the ketubah. In other words, the court merely focused on what they felt was the binding legal document in this particular transaction. They felt that the antenuptial agreement, that's entered into by lawyers, and it's in English, and it's understandable, and the amounts are easily ascertained. So they felt that this was really the binding document and contract, and the ketubah, even though it was signed afterwards, was not considered to be an abrogation in any form of the antenuptial agreement. So one could make the argument that when a couple enters into a prenuptial agreement that says the wife is waiving anything from the husband, that even if the ketubah is not explicitly identified, that's the way that it would generally be understood, much the way that the court, in the case that came before it, understood it under those circumstances. And therefore, as I mentioned before, it is very important for lawyers to specifically carve out the ketubah in the prenuptial agreement.
So it also would be okay if the rabbi would explain to them and make sure they both understood what the ketubah said.
That's always a good thing. Even if he did, the court was not impressed because they had this other document that seemed much more legal and much more binding. So the question then becomes with respect to the third condition of the Rambam. The third condition that the Rambam mentioned is the husband's his relinquishment of the Yerusha of the inheritance that he would otherwise inherit from the wife. So what did we say? We said that that also is completely null and void. But the problem is that the Gemara doesn't seem to be so sure about that, right? We said that there are occasions in which we do permit somebody. This is the din of Rav Kahana. Rav Kahana in the Gemara in Ksuvos and Daf Pei Gimel says that we do allow a husband to relinquish his rights and to nakla ba'alolim mimakom acher as long as he's doing it before the Nisuin, right? As long as he's relinquishing his right to the Yerusha before the Nisuin, then that would be valid. And the Rambam says that too. So what does the Rambam mean? When the Rambam says that the husband can't waive the Yerusha, he means that the husband can't waive the Yerusha after the Nisuin has already taken place. But before the Nisuin has taken place, then he would be able to waive it. And this helps to explain what is a very confusing discussion among the Rishonim, based on a passage in the Gemara in Ksuvos. And I want to focus on this today because I think that it's worthwhile given our discussion and our conceptual framework that we're establishing, and then we'll get into some of the more nitty-gritty applications, bizman hazeh, of how to properly devise one's estate. Yes?
If the Katan ever ruled that the ketubah was not enforced, does that mean there was no marriage?
No, there would still be a marriage. In other words, the marriage is still a valid binding marriage, even if there is no ksuba. The remedy is to enter into a ksuba. Also, a couple could have a ksuba that is binding and in existence the entire term of their marriage, but then if, God forbid, they get divorced, the ksuba doesn't have to be collected at that point in time. They're not living together at that point in time. If they decide that they want to settle their monetary differences independent of the ketuba at that point in time, they may do so. In fact, most couples do so. It's very standard at the time in which a get is delivered, we turn to the wife and we say, now that we're delivering the get to you, do you waive your rights under the ketubah? And most of the time, the wife will say, yes, I waive my rights under the ketubah because we've already settled everything. Or we're settling things independent of the ketubah. It's just very important that she have the ability to invoke the ketubah at any time during the marriage that they're still living together. It's kind of an interesting concept. That's why the Ramah thought that you could do away with ketubah altogether. This is something which is a little bit shocking and maybe comes across as scandalous, but the Ramah in his commentary to Shulchan Aruch says explicitly nowadays that a man can't divorce his wife against her will. He thinks that maybe you don't need the ketubah anymore, because the purpose of the ketubah is shlo te kala ve'enav lotzia. that a man should not precipitously jump to divorce his wife, and he should realize, oh, if he's going to divorce his wife, he's going to have to pay a certain sum of money. So that made a lot of sense before the takana of Rabbeinu Gershom came along. Rabbeinu Gershom then made the takana over 1,000 years ago that a man is not allowed to divorce his wife. He can't marry more than one wife. Everyone knows that one. The Chayim of Rabbeinu Gershom. But he also decreed that a man is not allowed to divorce his wife against her will. So once she can't be divorced against her will, he already has an impediment towards getting rid of his wife, and that is that she would have to agree to it. So says the Ramah, since clearly he's going to have to negotiate some amount of money to get her to agree to be divorced in the first place, so therefore it doesn't seem that there is as compelling a need for the ketubah. And all the other meforshim, all the other achrodim, disagreed with the Ramah and said, no, there still is a need for the ketubah, because first of all, there are cases where you have an almana, for example, you have a widow, it's not a question of a man deciding to divorce his wife, he just dies and the widow is entitled to the value of the ketubah. And they gave other answers of various cases where it's very, very clear that even if you accepted the Ramah's argument, the ketubah is still going to be relevant. And also, we have cases where a wife will say, yes, she agrees to be divorced, but she wants to receive the amount of the ketubah. That's exactly the amount that she's asking for, and it's appropriate that the ketubah be in place. So, whatever the explanation, we certainly do require the ketubah even these days. But when Moshe Feinstein was asked the question of what is the value of the ketubah, because sometimes I get asked this question as well. People say, how much is the ketubah worth nowadays? Couples getting divorced, and they just want to know what's the value of the ketubah. And Moshe Feinstein was asked this question, and he said, wow, that's a really good question. I very rarely get asked this question. He said the reason, really the same as the Ramah said, the reason I very rarely get asked this question is because nowadays that people have to basically come to an agreement to get divorced. Nobody's allowed to divorce each other against their will. Therefore, there's normally some sort of a negotiated settlement. Again, it's not supposed to be negotiated based on blackmail or extortion or unfair leverage, but whatever is reasonable under the circumstances, people negotiate normally some sort of a settlement. So it doesn't come up, he said, so much for somebody to actually pay out the value of the ketubah. But then he goes into a whole discussion of how we would, in fact, evaluate the ketubah nowadays. So Moshe's own opinion, based on his assessment, remember there are two components to your typical ketubah. There's the 200 zuz component, then there's the 200 zukukim component, which is the Tosefes ketubah. So mostly based on his assessment of how we calculate the Masayim zukukim, the 200 zukukim, he came to the conclusion that the value of a ketubah nowadays is 100 pounds of silver. So when we do have cases that appear before the Beis Din where it's relevant to calculate the ketubah, the parties want the Beis Din to distribute to the assets or to award the finances in the dissolution of the marriage according to strict Jewish law, according to strict halakha. So often in America, the default standard that is invoked is that of Moshe Feinstein. There's also that of the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish held that it came out to more than that. There's the standard of Rav Chaim Nauk, held that it comes out to a lot less than that. But that was Ramosha's standard. It's an interesting question because it just doesn't come up that much. People normally waive the ketubah amount.
Because of alimony. In other words, she's getting alimony.
She's getting some sort of other support.
Presumably more than
call it alimony, call it maintenance. It's some other amount which is not strictly calibrated based on the calculation of the ketubas.
One question. Yeah. During a marriage, if a husband hands the money, 200 zukukim kesef, zuz, to the wife, the next day, can he still live with her?
There has to be a ketubah in place, a ketubah obligation in place.
So even if he hands her the money of the ketubah and she's holding it...
That's a discussion. If there's money which is set aside for the ketubah, so it could be set aside for the ketubah. You know, that could be potentially okay.
I mean, when
okay.
She says, I...
Shokanara talks about that. Talks about setting aside money for the ketubah, which could be okay if
so
done in a certain way.
But she waives her right.
Not a waiver, but as a way of setting it aside. What we call sorry aspiso. Set aside in a particular way. Now, if you take a look in the Gemara in Kesuva, so the Mishnah says, let's say that the husband writes that I do not have any, only the Nechsayach Peirusein, this is not in the materials, I apologize, but Chayach Hamosek, that I do not have any rights to any of your nechassim, to any of your possessions. Normally a husband gets to eat the peiros of her nechsei milug. He gets to eat the fruit of her possessions, of her fruit, the fruit of her field and so forth, right? Or what we call the usufruct of the assets that she has. So, in oka peiros b'chayeh, so we say he has the right to remove himself from benefiting from her assets. We may say in Yorsha, not only that, but if she dies, because he has said even Bimosa, even when she dies, I'm not going to be entitled to anything, so he would not inherit her. So comes along on Shimon Gamliel, and he says, no, he may say Yorshana. No, if she dies, he still inherits her, because he made it tonight, made a condition on that, which the Torah allows him to have. The Torah allows him to inherit her. That's what Shimon Gamliel says. It could be he holds that the Yerusha of a husband is a Torah law, but he says that you can't make a condition under those circumstances. So the Gemara says, the Rav holds like Rav Shimon Gamliel, he says that the condition would in fact be null and void. The husband makes such a condition that he's not going to inherit his wife, so that condition is considered to be null and void. He holds like Rav Shimon Gamliel, and the Gemara says, but he doesn't hold for his reason. Namely Rav Shimon Gamliel has a different set of reasoning than Rav. And then it talks about what's the different reasoning that they have. Maybe they disagree. The Rav Shimon Gamliel says this is because the Yerusha of a husband is min haTorah, and the Rav says, no, it's min drabanan. But nonetheless, despite the fact that it's min drabanan, we still would say that the condition is no good. But this is all working with the assumption that when you make a monetary condition, that the condition will be null and void, right? That's what we were discussing in the framework of Yerusha. And here we're saying that whether the husband's condition not to inherit his wife is valid or not depends on whether you hold that we would apply the principle of kol ha'masna ma'ashikasa b'Torah to null batil, that if you make a condition with respect to that which the Torah stipulates, that the condition would be void. But Rav Shimon Gamliel is assuming that this is a monetary condition. He just happens to hold that even with monetary conditions, he holds like Rabbi Meir, that the condition would be null and void. So comes along the Rif, and the Rif says this entire Gemara is out the window. Out of the window, says the Rif. Unbelievable. The Rif says that even though Rav says halacha is Rav Shimon Gamliel, leis hilchasa kavase. Halacha is not like him. Why is that? The Kai Malan, because we paskin, darish b'malon to know kayam. Very interesting. We are discovering an entire universe of sugyas that deal with Yerusha in different contexts as a Dava Shiva Mamon, and say that if I hold that as a general principle that a Dava Shiva Mamon, you can make a condition about that, you can make a condition about Yerusha as well. It's interesting. That's perhaps one of the most startling revelations. So I'm really delving into the sugyas over here. So that's what the Rif says. So comes along the Balamor, and the Balamor says, wait a second. Comes over, the Rif said, that the Rif said that we should change the halacha, that we don't hold, even though Rav said that we hold like Rav Shimon Gamliel, that the condition of the husband is invalid, says, no, we don't hold that way, because we hold that the condition in monetary matters is in fact valid. So says the Baal HaMor, I'm going to resuscitate Rav Shimon ben Gamliel. I'm going to resuscitate him. Lo kach ni rabanu, she'ein lako tamen alok shebiyadenu, that we should not uproot our Gemara. The Rif brought a Yerushalmi that seemed to support him. He said, no. The Bavli trumps the Yerushalmi. So why is this different? He says, v'avagav d'kayim lam bi'ama t'naim amamun kayim, even though normally we hold the monetary conditions are valid, shiny achav, this is different, to Yerusha memela kahavya. So that sounds familiar, right? He says, Yerusha just happens by itself. Who do we say said that svara? That was the Rashba, right? The Rashba had a svara like that. But since Yerusha just happens by itself, so once Yerusha vests in the husband, so then the husband doesn't have the ability to waive the Yerusha anymore to make a condition that he's not going to receive the Yerusha. So there is another way out of all of this, which is that we pointed out it really depends on when this condition is taking place of the husband, right? Is it taking place at the time of the erusin, or is it taking place at the time of the nisuin? Because if the husband makes this condition at the time of the erusin, So then we said that he does have the ability to make the condition that he's not going to inherit a wife, right? And that's because it's not a milsa de memela at that point, because he doesn't have any shaykes, he doesn't have any bios, he doesn't have any vested interest in the Yerusha until the time of the Nisuin. So says the Magen Mishnah in Perek Chof Gimel Hilchos Ishus Halacha. Hey, he says, I found, you know who says this? He says, I found this in the Rambam himself. I found this in the Tshuva of the Rambam. See, up to now, we've been very conventional. We've been just looking at the Halachas of the Rambam and the Mishnah Torah. But the Rambam also wrote Tshuva. Sometimes he wrote wild things in the Tshuva, so things that we find rather remarkable, certainly things that are of immense importance. So the Rambam wrote about his understanding of this Halach and his Tshuva. So this is, let's look at the Magen Mishnah's description of the tshuva of the Rambam in this subject. The Ksam Sofer also loses tshuva of the Rambam in his commentary on the Maseches Ksuvos and Daf Pei Gimel Amud Aleph. Says the Matzasi, the tshuva of the Rabbeinu, Shusover sheDin Mishnah who b'masnach haNisuin. He says that the din of the Mishnah, the Rabban Rambam Shimon ben Gamliel are talking about, all right, where the Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel says that the Tanai is batil, that the condition is null and void, okay? So when is it that the condition is null and void? That's only when it's after the Nisuin. And then the Rif comes along, and the Rif says, oh, but even then, we're going to hold that the condition is a valid condition, because we hold that you're allowed to make conditions with respect to monetary matters. But on this point, the Rambam disagrees with the Rif. Why is that? Because after the Nisuin, of course the condition is going to be no good. Because every single Tanai B'Yerusha, according to the Rambam, is batel, because it becomes Chukas Mishpat. So in other words, after the Nisuin, the Rambam is of the opinion that's already in Chukas Mishpat territory. It's no longer a Tanai Shibimamon. About Arusa, Tanai Kayam. But if we are dealing with an Arusa, so then the condition would be completely valid. So he says, if you look in the Ramban, the Machamos, in his commentary to the Rif, so the Ramban says that the Rif, when the Rif says that the condition would be valid, right? He says that that's talking about with an Arusa. So that's why the condition would be valid, because it's talking about an Arusa. Hemsworth says, "V'kvarkasafki shadas Ramban ve'arashba kadas rabbeinu minyan adin." And they hold that the Rif was talking about an Arusa. So of course there it would in fact be a regular Tanai Shibimamon.
It's not clear from the Gemara what
the right, the Gemara just leaves out any discussion in general about what stage we're talking about in terms of this machlokes between the Tanakama and Maman Shimon and Gamliel in the Mishnah. And therefore he says that this is how we can explain it. And if you take a look at the Chassam Sofer, so the Chassam Sofer also says he quotes Rabbeinu Tam. He says, "Vinei Rabbeinu Tam," and we'll finish with this. How much time do we have before Maariv, or is the time already? No, it's only we have for about 5 minutes, right? Okay, good. So he quotes Rabbeinu Tam. He says, "Vinei Rabbeinu Tam." So he says, Rabbeinu Tam brings a different question. He says that normally we hold that whenever Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel states the din in the Mishnah, we paskin like Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. And here, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel is saying that the Tanai is going to be batul mavutul, right? That the husband's Tanai, that he's not going to inherit his wife, is going to be batul mavutul. And yet, it's based on Rabbi Shimon Gamliel's Savara that whenever you make a Tanai with respect to a monetary condition or a monetary law of the Torah, that the Tanai is invalid. But we already established, and we paskin like Rabbi Yehuda, that the Tanai is valid. So how do you reconcile this? He says, V'anim kaimalan, masna mashikasta b'Torah, Tanai kayim b'mamon. So he says, V'kush ha-zutirtze yafra b'geras ha-ramam. So he also quotes the Chuvas ha-ramam, saying this is really what the Chuvas ha-ramam comes to answer. B'sofa sefer, the Rambam Shimon ben Gamliel, mode b'yamot, the Tanai kayim. He says, Yes, we pass like Rav Shimon Gamliel. Rav Shimon Gamliel really normally does hold that a Tanai is Kayim. He's not saying that the Tanai is not Kayim. He's saying this is a special case. Achacha b'Yerusha k'sib, v'haya lachem l'chukas mishpat, chuka ikuva. He's saying that Rav Shimon Gamliel himself, the reason why he says that the Tanai is not valid over here is not based on Tanai Shimamama. Never mind that those are the words that are used by the Mishnah. But what he really means is that this is a special kind of Tanai, which is not a normal kind of Tanai Shibamamon, but rather this is a Tanai Shibisa of the Chukas Mishpat. And what are we talking about? So the Rambam would say that this would only be referring to Nisuin and not to Erisin. Vayem Lashon of the Rambam, Vayem Ashkas the Rambam, Mevuah Demina Nisuin Shaya Chukas Mishpat Avalomina Erisin. That the Rambam would say that when is it that we would apply this Svara of Chukas Mishpat? It's only from the Nisuin and not from the Erisin. And the Rambam, he says, would interpret the Mishnah as referring to the Erisin, and therefore in this Mishnah, we would not paskin like Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, according to the Rambam's understanding. But the bottom line is that it depends upon whether we're dealing with the Nisuin or the Erisin. If we're dealing with the Nisuin, we're going to say that's already in Chukas Mishpat territory. You can't make a condition because that's a Dovah Shabbasar. Just like we mentioned, you can't make a condition with respect to the Ksuva because as the Lechem Mishnah explains, it's a Dovah Shabbasar. But once I'm dealing with the Erisin and it hasn't vested yet, so therefore that's not considered to be a Dovah Shabbasar. That's a regular Dovah Shabbamalon that the husband would have the right to relinquish or to make a condition that he's not going to inherit from his wife.
How would argue?
Yes.
That the Gemara must be talking about after Nisuin, or else it wouldn't be a man and his wife.
No, we're talking about when
people.
Be a man
and his fiance.
Well, let's look at the lashon here.
She's an ashesi after patrol, after the kedushin.
No, it simply says kasav law. Kasav law. He writes to her. So again, all of these sugyas are talking about people when they're in the process of getting married. The process of getting married could be the Erisin. The process of getting married could be the Nisuin. So we're talking about that it could very well be referring to when they're in the Erisin. But it could be either. You're right. It lends itself to either interpretation.
And when we said last yes. week, the Chazanish said that the Rambam made up this drush about Chukas Mishpat.
Yes. The Rambam there is no such drush in the Gemara. That's for sure.
Right.
So the Rambam would say he's going to, the Rambam, when he comes up with this drasha, he's not going to give himself all the credit. The Rambam was a humble person. So the Rambam would say, I have gleaned from all the sources of Torah Shabbat that this is what the Gedolim before me had in mind when they spoke about not making a condition with respect to Yerusha. And this surely must be what Rav Shimon ben Gamliel had in mind as well, that the reason why you can't make this type of a condition is because it's considered to be Chukas Mishpat.
But he doesn't present an alternate argument besides Chukas Mishpat to Chazanish as to why you can't make a Tanai by the Ksuva.
Well, yes, he does. I mean, but by the Ksuva, the Chazanish is specifically referring to Yerusha. But he says, because Yerusha is a Milsa de Mimela. I mean, he talks about that. That's the notion of it being a Milsa de Mimela. But he says that really that's what the Rambam means. I mean, he reads that into the Rambam. The Rambam's saying it can't work because it's a Milsa de Mimela. The Rambam, though, seems to be going further. The Rambam's saying, no, it's actually a Dovah Shabbisr, that it has this powerful quality, that it's a Dovah Shabbisr. That quality sets in at the time of the Nisuin, at least with respect to the husband-wife relationship. A husband-wife relationship is interesting because we say that there is the ability, there's a point in time in which the husband can still he could still remove himself from becoming a vested title holder in his wife's Yerusha as long as he relinquishes that right before the Nisuin sets in. We say that, for example, a Yavam has the right to, the Ksos writes this in Siman Reish Ayin Ches in the Sif Katan Yud Gimel, Kol Shemishpa. The Ksos says that we find this elsewhere as well. We find that a Yavam who's going to take over his brother's estate has the ability to relinquish his prospective right in taking over the Yerusha that his brother had been entitled to, that he can say that I'm going to give up that right. I'm going to give up a portion of that right. I'm not going to step into his shoes entirely in that respect, because he's not there yet. Before the time that he's performed the Ma'aseh Yibum, he's not there yet. The other case that so says, where we find that this is applicable, is when it comes to a Bechor, because a Bechor, we say that Lasis Lo Pishnayim, the Torah calls it a Matana. Just because Torah calls it a Matana, so therefore we say that until the Bechor actually has it, the Bechor has the ability to be Mesalik himself, to relinquish his rights to the Bechorah as well. And he says that that's what was going on with respect to the sale, so to speak, of the Bechorah from Esav to Yaakov. He said that Esav didn't yet have it to give it away, so it wasn't in Davar Shelo Bal Yoram. So he answers that since Esav indicated that the Yerusha was in Ve'ivaz Esav is a Bechorah, what's the lashon that we have over there, Mali Zeha Bechora, some lashon like that, that what does he need it for? So says the Ketzos, that was a lashon of siluk. It was a lashon of relinquishment, that he had the ability to relinquish prior to the moment in which he would actually have it. So these are the different cases where he says that there is the ability to do that. A baal before the nisuin of his wife, before he performs nisuin with his wife, the yavam before he actually performs the ma'aseh yibum, and a bechor before he receives the bechor. Okay, we'll stop here.